Yes.
If I had known that.
Yeah, if you'd known that was an option. Yeah. All right, good afternoon, everybody. This is the afternoon session of the Portland City Council, Thursday, February 15, 2018. Carla, please call the roll.
Fritz. Fish.
Here.
Saltzman. Udaly.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here. So the purpose of council sessions is to conduct the city's business. Any disruptions of testimony or deliberations are not allowed. If people like what they're hearing, a thumbs up works. If you don't like what you're hearing, a thumbs down works. We ask people not to clap or boo or in any other way be disrespectful to the people providing testimony or council deliberations. Occasionally that does happen. If it does happen, you'll be asked to stop. If you do not stop, you'll be asked to leave. And if you do not leave when asked to do so, you're subject to arrest for trespass. So let's hope none of those things happen. Let's all have an opportunity to hear what is going on today. So today we have one item. Carla, I'll let you read it.
Item 152, transmit report to the City of Portland on Police Bureau officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths by the Office of Independent Review.
So a couple of things. First of all, the obligation here is to transmit the report. We have chosen to do so in public by having OIR and the director of IPR give this presentation in a public forum where it is televised for the public's benefit. This is not a formal report, meaning it does not require any action or vote on the part of the City Council. OIR has been asked to give a presentation to the City Council, and that's what they are doing. We are not taking oral testimony on this report. However, written testimony will be greatly appreciated for people who may disagree with either the report's findings or with our acknowledgement of those findings. Here's the run of show today. I'm going to offer some brief opening remarks. IPR Director Constantine Sevier is going to open up the presentation. He will introduce the presenters from the OIR group, which have prepared the report that I hope many people in this room have now had the opportunity to go through thoroughly. The City Council, of course, will ask questions of OIR, and I had a conversation with them yesterday where they said they would be happy to have us just ask questions informally as their testimony unfolds. Chief Outlaw will then deliver some remarks and reactions to the report from OIR, and she's here today, and we thank her. We will then ask if there are any other questions or feedback from the council or from OIR or from the chief or Constantine, and with that, we will end it. So there's been some questions as to why are we not taking public testimony today, and I want to just reiterate, council oral testimony is taken on resolutions and first readings of ordinances. Items like this do not require any formal action on the City Council, do not necessarily have public testimony. It has been my practice as mayor not to take public testimony, particularly on informal presentations to the City Council or to proclamations. This is obviously a very important issue to the city at large, and so I want to reiterate, if people hear something today in the OIR report that they disagree with, or if they hear anything in either my comments or the chief's comments that they disagree with, we want to hear from you. We will take written testimony at the following email address, cctestimony, so the letters CC, cctestimony at portlandoregon.gov. Again, it's cctestimony at portlandoregon.gov. And of course, we have the Police Bureau and others presenting on a wide array of issues related to policing and public safety over the course of the year in our regular meetings. And we always encourage people to come and orally testify for the first readings of ordinances and resolutions specific to those items. So, colleagues, with that, I just want to state the obvious. Any officer-involved shooting under any circumstances is tragic by its very nature. deadly force is without question the most critical decision any officer will make. And as a country right now, we need to acknowledge the environment that we're in. The dialogue regarding deadly force has been on the forefront of people's mind. It has been on the forefront of the national news. And as a community's Portlanders know all too well the devastating impact of an officer-involved shooting. Officers are entrusted to make decisions under very challenging circumstances. It goes without saying that a shooting can result in the loss of life. Families are left in despair. Police officers' lives are deeply impacted. And these things, as we know from our experience as a community, they tear at the very fabric of our community. And that's why reviews like this one being presented today, an unvarnished view of policies and procedures in the Portland Police Bureau related to officer-involved shootings, are so critically important to not only seeing where we are, but acknowledging the work that we have to do. Training is in place to make sure that officers' decisions are good, and it's important that we get that training right to make clear that, make sure that officers have the correct foundation from which to make important decisions about the use of force. This also highlights the need for continued accountability in our city, which we've seen through the settlement agreement with the Department of Justice, the strengthening of the Independent Police Review, the Citizen Review Committee, and again, I want to thank all of the citizens who participate in that process, and soon the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, the PSEP. OIR has served as a critical foundation for our city as a third-party reviewer of officer-involved shootings in Portland for the last several years. Their reviews have enabled us to assess whether PPB's current policies and training are reflected in practice. On the whole, they have reported to me as recently as yesterday that they believe the Bureau has evolved for the better over the years. There are several recommendations that are already in practice by the Bureau, with one recommendation that's in the process today of being implemented. Notably, our new chief, Danielle Outlaw, hired for her skill and for her vision, has taken stock of this report, and I'm told she agrees with all 26 recommendations provided in the report. Furthermore, as will be explained for many of these recommendations, Chief Outlaw has imposed a clear timeline for when the specific issue must be resolved. These are her directives to her Bureau members. Anyone who does not meet her expectations will be held accountable. I want to be very clear, having thoroughly read through this report, I too agree with these recommendations. And I will support Chief Outlaw in implementing these recommendations. And I, too, will have expectations that they will be implemented per the timeline that is put into place by Chief Outlaw. A few things that are already being implemented, the 48-hour rule. A few of these cases that we're going to hear about today highlight the problematic nature of the 48-hour rule, which the city had in place for approximately 10 years. City Council rightly eliminated the 48-hour rule from the police union contract and rightly made that elimination permanent when we took active steps to craft amendments to the Portland Police Bureau's use of force policy, ensuring that officers are interviewed as soon as possible, but no more than 48 hours after an incident. This is a much-needed step in the right direction, and I want to thank my colleagues here, and I want to thank many people who are in the room today who played an active role in helping us to get to the right place on the 48-hour rule. In terms of the timing of investigations, the OIR group's reports correctly finds fault with the city for the length of investigations that run too long at the expense of complainants and police officers. The DOJ settlement agreement has imposed a 180-day time limit on all investigations. The Bureau has been working to identify the sources of delays and implement a process that provides for regular follow-ups of affected cases. I applaud the Police Bureau for recognizing this important issue and being proactive about finding common sense solutions. With regard to viewing footage before writing reports, this has probably been one of the most significant flashpoints for this particular report. Permitting officers to review audio or video footage prior to writing a report has obviously been highly controversial in this community. I would argue with good reason. I want to clarify that the city never granted officers the right to view footage prior to writing their reports. I recognize that this is likely subject to collective bargaining with the union, but I want to state unequivocally my position today. Officers should not be permitted to review audio or video footage prior to writing their reports, as per the recommendation in the OIR report. This is not only in line with best practices, I believe it's common sense. I want to thank the OIR group for their critical eye in conducting this work. We always have room for improvement. This report makes several recommendations, and I'm certain with our new chief we will continue meeting our goals as a city and improving public safety for everyone. Director Sevier, why don't you come on up and make your opening remarks and then introduce our presenters today. Thank you for being here. And I want to acknowledge our auditor, Mary Hull Caballero, is here as well. Thank you, auditor.
Well, good afternoon, Mayor, members of council. My name is Constantine Sevier. I'm the director of the Independent Police Review. One of the most significant parts of my job as the IPR director is, one, acting as a monitor and going to the scene of officer-involved shooting. And I really appreciated the mayor's words talking about how officer-involved shootings are a tragedy, both for the affected persons and for the involved officers. The other significant part of the IPR director's job is to serve as the city's contact point with outside experts, such as OIR, for them to do their external review. And that is something that the city code set up back in 2001 when IPR was created. And I think the fact that Portland, which is one of the few cities around the country that does an external review of every officer-involved shooting, not just the most controversial, but every officer-involved shooting is subject to that outside review, speaks highly to our values as Portlanders, that we are able to take the critical lens and the critical view of an outsider and make our own processes better. And so in the last 16, 17 years of the existence of the external review of officer-involved shootings, Portland has gone from a system where not every officer-involved shooting was subject to an administrative investigation. And in multiple cases back in the 90s and early 2000s, there was not a full criminal investigation. The expectation now through the police bureau directives and the direction of the police commissioner is that every officer-involved shooting would be subject to an administrative investigation and a criminal investigation. One of the critical issues with officer-involved shootings is the timeliness of them, which the mayor has brought up. That has been an issue that OIR has brought up numerous times in its previous reports. The Police Bureau has made significant progress in the timeliness of its investigations. The elimination of the 48-hour rule, I think, is critical in helping the timeliness of the investigation. And when the city faced the issue of engaging with the district attorney's office regarding the ability for the city to be able to do administrative investigations in a timely manner, OIR was critical to the feedback that I was able to provide to the police commissioner on how strongly our office felt, both in real time and the number of reports and recommendations that OIR had made to the city. And it was part of the community conversation about how important the elimination of the 48-hour rule was. So another one of the significant issues with these outside reviews is that OIR and before the Police Assessment Resource Center have made a number of recommendations to the city of improving its administrative and criminal investigations. And for the most part, the city has accepted most of the recommendations, but there have been a few recommendations that have taken the city a number of report cycles for it to fully implement, both like the 48-hour rule, like the improving the timeliness of investigations, and when the city has failed to take advantage of these outside experts and not fully implement the recommendations, we have paid a consequence for that. As a result of the city's failure to have more timely investigations, it ended up being a condition of the settlement agreement with the Department of Justice. So now I will just introduce the experts from OIR. Michael Giannacco and Julie Rulin are here today to provide counsel their presentation. Mr. Giannacco is a former Civil Rights Division attorney in the Justice Department, as well as serving in the Central District of California as the lead attorney in that U.S. Attorney's Office at, Civil Rights Division. Ms. Rulin is a former expert who is on the staff of PARC and is a former civil rights litigator and criminal defense attorney. So,
excellent. Yeah. Thank you, Director. Appreciate it. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to see you both.
Thank you
very much. It's good to be here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor. Good
afternoon.
Commissioner Utley, Commissioner Fish. It's good to see some new faces and some familiar faces as well. And am I getting an echo? Can everyone hear me okay? I think
yeah,
we're good.
It's unfortunate. The acoustics in this room are a little odd, so you just sort of have to deal with it. Sorry about that.
I will proceed.
Thank you.
Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to be before you. Thank you for receiving our report. And thank you for your opening remarks, Mr. Mayor. I couldn't agree more with all of what you have said up to now. There is nothing, and because our work has extended beyond the city of Portland, and we have had, unfortunately, the responsibility to review 500 or 600 officer-involved shootings, we couldn't agree more about how when an officer uses deadly force, it always creates, in fact, it's always a tragic event, particularly if somebody is injured or killed, but always presents trauma not only to the family, to those who are involved more closely, to the individual being shot, to the police officer himself or herself who uses deadly force, to the police agency as a whole, and to the community as a whole. These kind of incidents resound in a significant way and potentially can tear the fabric with regard to the relationship of trust between police and those who are policed, their community. And for that reason and because of the consequences that a deadly force incident does on impacting the community and the family, the officer, the department, it's incumbent upon agencies to conduct a thorough, objective, fair investigation into this incident for a number of reasons. One, and this is a district attorney responsibility eventually, but to determine whether or not the actions of the officers run afoul of state law with regard to use of force, but also to evaluate the incident to determine whether or not the incident is consistent with the expectations of the police agency itself, is consistent with the directives of that police agency, is consistent with the way in which the officer who uses deadly force has been trained, and also whether the act itself and all the events leading up to the act and subsequent to the incident are carefully reviewed to determine, one, what happened? Two, is there a way we can do better? With the idea that that kind of holistic review, introspection, reflection, and identification of remedial measures, including accountability, training, policy development, can help lessen the likelihood that a similar deadly force incident will occur. Will we get to zero? I think that is ultimately the goal of getting to zero. Will it happen overnight? No. But we can say that, in our estimation, as reflected in this report and in our past reports, of the 41 shootings we have reviewed in the course of our responsibilities here, that there has been a trend line that has been optimistic. And for that reason, we continue to appreciate the work that we are able to do and the ability to report to your public and your community about that trend line. This is we have yet to find an officer-involved shooting in the review of the 600 or so shootings we've done that has been done, quote, perfectly. And we have also found that in every incident where deadly force is used, as justifiable as it may be, there are lessons to be learned if an agency takes the time and consideration to do so. And it's that philosophy that guides us and what sort of drives us as we come up with our reflections, our findings, and our recommendations. The recommendations are intended to improve the department, to improve the Bureau in this case, and to, again, better prepare not only the Bureau but its officers in providing additional guidance, additional procedures, process, in an idea that that will all lead to a better and more robust review process, with the exhaust pipe being better guidance to officers, better guidance to supervisors in the Bureau on ways to train officers, guide officers, and reduce the likelihood that deadly force will be used. I'm going to end my initial comments at this point, as the mayor indicated, certainly open for questions either now or during the course of our discussion, during the course of our presentation, or at any time at the end of our remarks. But I wanted to reflect a little bit on some of the common themes that we found in this report, but I'm going to ask my colleague Julie Rulin to do that at this point.
Michael, can I just ask you a kind of a referee's question before you get into the merits, and that is, did you experience any barriers to getting the information you needed, which formed the basis of your analysis and your recommendations?
No. And as reflected in our report, Commissioner Fish, in order for us to effectively do our job, we need total access to all information, including confidential information or any information that exists relating to the incident that we're reviewing. And to answer your question as succinctly as I can, we didn't receive any barriers at all with regard to that. And that has been true throughout our assignment.
Julie?
Yeah. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Mayor and commissioners. Thank you for having us and for giving us this opportunity to present some of the findings in our report. This report, we talk about six officer-involved shootings. Two of those were fatal shootings. Three of them resulted in injuries to the person being shot at, and one of them was a non-hit shooting that nonetheless received the same level of scrutiny from the Bureau and the same level of review from us. Rather than go through the circumstances of each of those incidents, I thought we would focus on some of the common themes that emerged from our review. And the first is really to talk about the way in which officers' tactical decision-making is reviewed. And that's always a big focus of our reviews, and we believe it should be an important part of any agency's review of a critical incident, because we found that tactics that improve officer safety also reduce the likelihood that an officer is going to find him or herself in a position where he or she feels the need to use deadly force. So a focus on tactical decision-making is an important part of the review process, and that's all of the things that come before the shooting. Of course, the investigation and review has to talk about the moment of the trigger pull and the actual use of force, but we find it's also very important to talk about all the things that went before that, that came before. And the Bureau does an admirable job of addressing all of those issues. And in fact, the training division review that is a written document that's part of the review process is something that is relatively unique among the agencies that we work with elsewhere. The fact that the Bureau takes its subject matter experts in the training division and tasks them with pulling apart each of these incidents and discussing whether at various points the decision-making was in line, was consistent with the Bureau's training, I think shows a willingness by the Bureau to learn from these incidents and to have that kind of rigorous self-scrutiny. That's really an important part of an agency's review.
So could I ask you a question? On recommendation 20, you suggested that the protocols be changed to explicitly review pre-shooting tactical decision-making for this purpose. Is that done now, or do you have a sense?
It's not a thing that's listed out as part of the review. So the use of force is reviewed. The post-incident supervisory response is explicitly reviewed. And while much of this decision-making, it's very much a part of the training division review, it's not an explicit part of the commander's review. And then as a result, it's not a thing that requires an explicit vote from the police review board. And that was an area where we found some room for improvement in this report. For example, there is one of the shootings that we review in our report where the commander makes a finding that the decision-making leading up to the shooting was out of policy, was inconsistent with the Bureau's expectations. And that likely was part of the discussion at the police review board, but there's no express finding from the police review board as to whether why they disagree. There was no out-of-policy finding from the police review board and no written record of why that was so.
Is it possible to get, and we see a common theme throughout these, that the decision is ultimately made when the officer feels their life is at stake. Is there a best practice, or is there anything concrete that you could point me to by way of a strategy that's implemented elsewhere that's very effective in terms of reviewing the pre-shooting tactical decision-making and then how that is actually integrated into training?
Yes, Mayor. Largely as a result of a negotiated settlement agreement or consent decree, the city of Los Angeles for a long time has been reviewing officer-involved shootings. One of their recent developments is to do what we recommend, which is force the review board to make a determination as to whether tactics were consistent with policy, consistent with training, or suboptimal or optimal. And coming out of that forced decision, which isn't the current situation in Portland, I think will be a better reflection of what the review board thought of those tactics. Right now, they have the option to go there, but they're not required to go there, if you will. So providing this sort of menu option, which is they're required to make a determination as to whether the officer objectively felt in fear for their life when they shot. They're required to make a determination as to whether the rescue of the individual who was downed and the emergency aid provided to the individual who was downed was timely, effective, and appropriate. They're not required to make a determination about whether the tactics were consistent with training or policy, and what we're advocating is that they should.
So you would direct me towards LA then? And their
I would,
degree.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. I appreciate
yes.
it.
One other piece regarding the review board process is something that is concerning to us in the new use of force policy and procedures, and that is a concern about the timing of this training division review. If you're going to have the police review board make decisions about make a finding about tactical decision making, we think it's very important that they have access to that training division review document. And there are some concerns that an interpretation of the new policy means that that training division review won't be done until after the police review board meets, which we think would hamper the ability of the PRB to make the necessary findings.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Another theme from this report, and it's a theme that it's been a common theme throughout many of our reports, and that is the role of supervisors on the scene of these incidents. And what we've found in a number of shootings over the course of our review is that a tendency for supervisors, for sergeants on the scene, to engage tactically in the incident. And the role of a sergeant at the scene of one of these emerging incidents ideally should be one of a director and not an actor. So somebody who's standing back and identifying what resources are necessary and which officer ought to be deploying which type of weapon and positioning and how you're going to manage the entire incident. And we have found repeatedly examples of sergeants wanting to jump into the role of an officer when there are officers available to play that role. The Bureau has always agreed with our recommendations on this, and there is training for sergeants that instructs them on the proper role during these incidents. That training curriculum is sound, but for whatever reason, it's not sort of sinking in, and there are, you know, a number of possible explanations for that. But what we have recommended in this report is that it might be time for the Bureau to say we're going to make this a formal policy, which will make it easier for us to, number one, reinforce this message in training, and number two, hold people accountable when they don't meet those expectations. A third area, sort of common theme that I wanted to talk about, though, Mr. Mayor, you addressed it very well in your opening comments, was the timing of when an officer will review video footage. We see this as a very controversial topic in many cities where body-worn cameras are being rolled out and there's a lot of video footage available of all these incidents. But even in the absence of body-worn cameras, more and more everyday life, what we do, what officers do, is captured on video. And so I think it's important for the Bureau to have a very clear policy on how they will handle this in the investigative realm. As you said, it is best practice, in our view, that officers provide a statement before they're allowed to view video. It seems unquestionable that the watching video can affect a person's memory in unconscious ways, even, and in unpredictable ways. And the goal, particularly in these incidents, where what we need to assess is an officer's state of mind at the time of the shooting, the goal ought to be to get a very clear and pure statement of that officer's memory.
And as I read your recommendation, you're not precluding officers from giving additional testimony once they've reviewed the video. You're just saying the initial interview should be prior to any audio or video, I guess I'll call it contamination.
Right.
So it's what they remember, as you say, the state of mind, the circumstances as they existed that they can remember to the best of their ability at that time, but then they can go back and review footage and they can come back and enhance their testimony based on the review of that footage later. Is that a fair statement of your recommendation?
Yes, I think that's accurate. And although I don't even know that it would have to be coming back, I think the mechanics of it would be that they give a statement, they're interviewed, they are asked questions about the incident, then have the opportunity during the course of that interview to watch the video. And then if they need to supplement their original statement to talk about what they saw in the video, then they're provided that opportunity right there. And I think it's really important to note here that inconsistencies between that initial statement and what an officer might say or what appears on the video. Inconsistencies don't necessarily mean the officer was lying. There are lots of reasons. Human memory is not perfect, and particularly under when we're under stress, you might perceive something differently than what you later see on video. Perspective could be different. So an officer sees some things from this perspective and the video camera's up there, it captures things differently. And so I think it's important in terms of managing the public's expectations and building trust with the officers that inconsistencies between that statement, between their memory, between how they perceive things and what's on the video, minor inconsistencies don't necessarily result in, you know, an accusation that that officer is lying, or should not result in that kind of accusation.
Very good. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. We appreciate the discussion and the presentation. I think, though, that in part because of the way in which Mayor Wheeler fleshed out essentially some of our critical findings and the Bureau's response, I'm going to end at least the substantive part of our presentation by the following, which is, again, to reinforce my response to Commissioner Fish. Not only have we had access to information, and that has been something that we have been benefited by throughout the course of our relationship with the city, but the Bureau also makes itself available as we have questions during our review process that aren't about information that isn't reflected in the documents. So when we are asking or have questions about a certain training process, when we have questions about the way in which things were done but may not have been fully documented, when we have questions about the protocols of the Bureau, all we need to do, and this has been true for years now, is simply find the right person to ask the question of, and the Bureau has been very responsive in providing helpful information to that effect. Oftentimes, what we will end up doing is saying, well, we wish you would have documented that, but it's been very helpful and productive. The other thing that I wanted to also reinforce is that our process is that, and when we are done with our initial findings, recommendations, and reflections, we have the opportunity to share that information with the Bureau prior to publication. And what we have found is that's been a very helpful dialogue for us. We're not perfect. We don't always get everything right. And that dialogue isn't intended to change the thrust of our recommendations, but more to make sure that for all kinds of purposes, including the fact that facts matter, I still think facts matter, that we ensure that we are as accurate as possible before we release our findings to the public.
I wanted to add one more thing about the Bureau cooperation, and that is I will regularly interact with sergeants or even officers on the Bureau who are very open and candid and clearly have gotten the message from their superiors up the chain of command that they're allowed to talk to us and they're allowed to interact with us freely and to share their viewpoint and their perspective. And that's important. Many organizations we work with will only deal with, you know, captains and above, and officers are too sort of nervous to talk to us or feel constrained. And that's not true in this Bureau, and I think that's an important statement about the tone that the command structure has set.
Mayor? Commissioner Fish.
We have the benefit of having some written testimony that's been submitted, and I think through the course of this hearing, we may from time to time refer to some comments made by members of the public to give you an opportunity to respond. And in the League of Women Voters submission, they focus, among other things, on recommendation number 5. So I'd like to take a moment to look at that. And this has to do with the providing medical attention to an injured individual. And as Ali points out, this is an issue that that has been discussed and reviewed now for a long time, dating back to as early as 2001 or before. In your recommendation, you address the question about the need to render or coordinate first aid as soon as possible, and that certainly makes sense, and should not instruct paramedics to downsize its response team in the interest of not disturbing evidence. So can you flesh that out a little bit? I can imagine a number of scenarios where someone might be concerned about bringing a paramedic in, an active shooting or other contingencies, but this question about the interest of not disturbing evidence, so how do you make that judgment, and what are the parameters? And when you say as soon as possible, can you put some boundaries on that and give us a sense of what kind of urgency you think should be brought to this question?
Absolutely, Commissioner. This is an issue that has been part of our dialogue with the Bureau and with the public and the community and with you all for years. And what we have seen, it might be important for contextual reasons to talk about what we saw when we first got started. We saw a number of cases in which after an individual had been downed by gunfire, Bureau personnel on scene would take a step back, you know, and then call the SWAT team or the CERT team, which is your version of SWAT, to respond, which could take, usually at least takes an hour and could take longer. So we'd have a situation where somebody was not moving, no showing, no signs of life from the perspective. CERT is called because there may be a weapon close by or what have you, and it would take a long, long time before that person would receive medical attention. It certainly, we don't see that anymore, fortunately, but we still do see, in one case, we highlighted this in our discussion, where the individual was downed, the officers eventually used a ballistic shield, which is a new device that keeps them safer and allows them to approach, and consistent with an earlier recommendation we made, they come up with a ballistic shield. They handcuff the individual so that once the individual's handcuffed, he's much less of a threat to them. And then they back off and call paramedics. But the instruction given to paramedics was, we only want two of you there. We want to make sure that we only want two of you there because we don't want shell casings to be disturbed or any other evidence or the gun that the individual had, which is an understandable, but in our view, rescue predominates over any need to disturb evidence. These cases are not whodunits. They're really about state of mind. Shell casings get kicked around all the time when there is an emergent need for paramedics to respond. So in our view, that it's really critical that particularly scene supervisors, sergeants who get on the scene immediately, be instructed that the need to provide medical attention needs to predominate over any concern about the sanctity of the evidence.
And it's fair to say that's a national best practice?
It is, indeed. And it's something that sometimes it's difficult for officers to transition to. You know, to go from tactical mode, where they've just used deadly force, to rescue mode, where they now are seeing an individual and now have to find ways to render first aid themselves or get the paramedics there, it's important. To the credit of this incident that I'm talking about, the paramedics had been called and were allowed to stage nearby, but the instruction was only bring two folks in because we don't want you to disturb evidence.
And, sir, does this relate back to what you said earlier about the cautionary flag about sergeants excessively engaged in the tactical side rather than being directors?
In part, although in this case the sergeant hadn't been tactical, but certainly we think that he, and it was a he in this case, really needs to be further guided about what's most important here, sanctity of evidence or preservation of life. And I think we can all agree that best practices say, and we can agree that life preservation is most important. I think that the officers on scene had a sense that the individual was beyond saving, but it's not their decision to make. That's a medical decision.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I did a little research since our conversation on this the other day, and it turns out that all officers are, in fact, trained in the deployment of tactical shields. That was part of the 2017 in-service training. Right. And they're actually more widely distributed than I expected. Every sergeant's vehicle has one. And so there's probably some training and communication improvement that has been made since the cases that you're reviewing for this report. And I just wanted to make note of that. The most controversial issue here in terms of getting a response was on this question of supervisory responsibility, particularly on the part of sergeants approaching a scene. And I got unvarnished feedback from which within the Bureau, and there were a couple of refrains. And the first is really on us. It was a question about resources and capacity. And ultimately, the council controls resources and capacity with regard to how many people are on the scene and how many people are available to actually be engaged at a tactical level versus a supervisory level. And the second was, I would generally characterize it as concern about being too prescriptive with regard to the role of the supervisor on scene. And what was mentioned to me was a specific case around communications where it was believed that really only the sergeant could handle the communications under a certain circumstance. And the question was raised, are you actually going to prescribe that the sergeant not be engaged in that function? And potentially, if you write it into policy, require remedial action from the sergeant as a result. How would you respond to those responses to the issue that you raised?
There are a couple ways to respond. I understand that writing something into policy and setting it, you know, it's not always good to create hard and fast rules that have no that officers have no ability to exercise some discretion to veer from. There might be exceptional circumstances. I understand that sergeants become sergeants because they're good officers. They did their job well. They're smart. They know what they're doing. They have experience. And sometimes it's hard for them, once they become a sergeant, to step back from that thing that they're very good at. And they know they're on the scene, and they think, I can do this better than this new officer. And that's a difficult position to be in. I get that. At the same time, if you don't give those officers the chance under your supervision, they're not going to learn to become the good, experienced officer that you had the chance to become. So I get that there are circumstances under which, you know, you might want a sergeant to step in, and they need to be able to recognize that. Should a policy completely remove all discretion? Probably not. I mean, we haven't suggested any particular wording for this policy. It's just the recommendation to reinforce this through training and accountability hasn't changed a lot. So the idea of having a policy was a recommendation in this report.
Very good. And if I could shift gears, and if any of my colleagues want to jump in, please just do. I want to talk about the timeliness of investigations. And as a new police commissioner coming in and realizing that I was being asked to look at investigations that were quite old, and in communicating with lots of people who are different parts of the process, everybody seemed really frustrated by the length of time it takes to complete an investigation. Could you elaborate on your findings and recommendations with regard to timeliness of investigations? And first of all, let's just stipulate that it's in the interest of the officer, and it is the interest of the individual who was recipient of officer involved use of force, and their family, to have this done quickly. So what are you recommending, and given our current structure, what would you change?
I think that timeliness is always needs to be balanced with thoroughness, and certainly we don't want to, and we're not intending to recommend that the thoroughness of the investigative process and review process that occurs in Portland be somehow subverted. On the other hand, it is important that these kinds of investigations be completed. The DOJ, Department of Justice, said so, and that was part of the settlement agreement regarding ways to collapse the time, if you will, in order to have more timely investigative and review process. And I think as a large part of that kind of oversight that currently exists here, the Bureau has done better, significantly better. That being said, there are times in which files seem to end up on people's desks for too long with not a lot of activity going on. So I just think that we don't have a specific recommendation or magic cure or magic bullet. This plagues every agency that has these responsibilities, and it's a fact that there's plenty of work to do for people who may not have enough resources to do it. That's an explanation, not a justification. And I just think that it's important for, and we're going to continue to watch it, but I think it's important for the management of the Bureau to continue to figure out ways to collapse that process without sacrificing the thoroughness and the robust review process that's currently in place.
So there were two recommendations that you may have not stated explicitly, but you certainly implied them. So I want to find out if that is true. The first regarding the question of internal affairs. And you stated explicitly at the head of that section that internal affairs, generally speaking, is not a bottleneck, but it becomes a bottleneck if somebody or a part of the process later on asks for additional interviews or follow-up information. And there is a competition for time, energy, and resource back at IAA for the follow-ups, and you seem to be suggesting that it's not the initial IA investigation that it's a problem, it's follow-up requests that are becoming problematic, and you had a recommendation there. First of all, did I state the problem accurately, and if so, what is your recommendation?
Mayor Whaley, you stated it accurately. Human nature being what it is once you as an investigator get rid of a case, you hate to see it come back. Sometimes it needs to come back, and sometimes there is important information that is missing from the file. Witnesses weren't asked the right question. Witnesses weren't interviewed at all. So that process is critical, and the Bureau is doing a pretty good job of doing that and sending things back, as well as IPR. IPR plays a role there as well as sort of another check on thoroughness. But our recommendation is that when an investigation, which is already old, because now it's gone through a review process, comes back for more investigation, that the commander of the Internal Affairs Unit ensure that the investigator who it's going back to put that at the top of the queue so that whatever else needs to be done is done, so that that review process can be completed.
You also highlighted the Police Review Board, the PRB, and you indicated in your report that meetings occurred at least 2 months after most case investigations were completed, and in half of the cases, 3 to 4 months later. What was causing that delay, in your estimation?
I think, I think that there are a lot of reasons, and everyone is sort of episodic, but if I had to generalize, which I will, I think some of it has to do with scheduling, availability. There does need to be some time built into the process so that those who are on the review board have an opportunity to review the cases, because these files are extensive, and it's important for any review board participant to have some amount of time to take a look at the cases so that they are steeped in the information, have looked at the raw data before they go to the board. That being said, there needs to be, I think, more adept scheduling and ensuring that, if at all possible, that window be collapsed to 30 to 45 days if possible.
And then I just have one more question. The training division review, there was some question as to where the right place is for the training division review. Should it be later and separate to maximize the training opportunities, or should it be earlier and integrated in order to speed up the process? Where did you come down on that?
Yeah. Well, we think it's really critical that the training division review be among the materials that the review board considers when making its findings. So we think that that's the overriding objective, is to make sure that that gets done in a way that it can be useful to the decision makers on this case.
And I would just add, Mayor Wheeler, we for those in the public who may not remember, critical components of the review board are people who are not experts in police practices. They're members of the CRC or members of the civilian community at large. And those individuals definitely need to be guided by the insights of the training review process in order to even formulate issues to discuss at the review board.
So the current policy, as I understand it, under 10-10-10, is that training analysis is provided only after the PRV has convened and made its findings. Is that correct?
The wordsmithing is a little ambiguous, Mayor, but the 10-10-10 currently talks about the training review being done after the, quote, review process. I'm not sure what that means, but it certainly could be interpreted to mean after the review board has completed its work, which is not what we think is ideal.
Very good. And I just want to be very clear, depending upon the chief's direction there, if it is her judgment based on her expertise and leadership that we should integrate that earlier, we will seek a revision, a policy revision through the ordinary process to 10-10-10. I just wanted to highlight that. That completes my questions. I don't know if my colleagues have any
Mayor,
more.
What other panels do we have?
We only have one. We have the chief.
So I'd like to hold my questions until we hear from the chief.
Very good. Thank you.
Mayor, I just want to close because I omitted two important things I think I would feel frustrated if I didn't communicate these, and that very briefly. Our work is guided by our experience and guided by the materials that the Bureau has provided to us, as well as the expertise and insight that the Bureau itself provides. But it's also guided by mechanisms that you have working day-to-day, boots on the ground. Individuals who are not with the Bureau, the IPR, the Auditor's Office, are instrumental, and we couldn't do the work we do without their guidance and understanding of what's going on in Portland. And then finally, an important piece of our component, and something that we absolutely benefit from when we come up to visit you all, is our ability to interface with your community. Because while the community may not be experts, although some are becoming experts on police practices, they certainly provide an important perspective and give us a better and general and broader understanding of the concerns of your community. And that dialogue that we're able to have only makes our report, I think, more informed. So we appreciate their work and their willingness to meet with us on a regular basis.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much. Chief Outlaw, welcome. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, Commissioner
afternoon.
Udaly, Commissioner Fish. Thanks for having me here today. The seats are always way down here in the microphone. Down out here. Thank you for the opportunity to respond. As I stated some time ago, I genuinely and wholeheartedly appreciate the opportunity to review and respond to the fifth report and the recommendations from the OIR group regarding officer-involved shootings that took place from March 2014 to June 2015. I think many of us are clear in that a true and comprehensive OIS review includes a lot of facets. And there really wasn't a lot of question for me when it came to whether or not I agreed with the 26 recommendations laid out in this report. OIS reviews do not only look at the incident itself, the use of force itself. It should include what led up to the incident. It also includes tactical consideration. It also takes a look at command and control.